Continuing our ongoing series with Professor Bill Murphy on artificial intelligence and the impact it will have on modern society, we're going to touch upon the impact AI will have on the legal industry. This is the UNH Law Podcast. Learn more about the law school and apply by visiting law.unh.edu. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or hosts and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire. So, Bill, artificial intelligence has been big when it comes to finding ways to expand technology sectors. Self-driving cars is an obvious example of late, but many people don't consider the ways it could affect the legal industry. Is human lawyering on its way out?
Well, there's good news and bad news. What do you want first?
Bad news.
the bad news is this is truly disruptive technology. Mm-hmm. As former waves of disruptive technology, there will be winners and losers. There will be people that won't be doing the job that they did in the same way. Right. When automobiles replaced horses, there were people that drove horses and knew how to take care of horses. It didn't mean we stopped transporting goods and people. We mm-hmm. just did it in a slightly different way. A lot of what we would consider as lawyering today, some of the particular skills will not be important skills in the future, and others will be. I think of it when I was in law school, we had something called Shepherds. It was a big tome that you had to look at to try to learn how a case was treated in subsequent cases. Lexis was just starting. Those of us in law school used it, but a lot of law firms didn't. So you had to learn this system of looking through books and cross-referencing this very complicated thing. And now it doesn't even exist. So people that were really great at that skill, it's not a skill you need anymore. I can just look it up and the computer does this for me now.
Yeah, I mean, even considering people who aren't in the legal industry, going to undergrad, I didn't really open up a physical book. It was entirely searching online databases. Even for non-lawyers, that's definitely the case.
Yeah, I saw that Pearson Publications today said they're not going to publish textbooks anymore. It's all going to be digital. There's no hard copy. When I started as an antitrust lawyer, we had tons of documents. And we looked through them. But we also had a computer that we did a taxonomy. We would use keywords because there's no way that you could get back at millions of documents. In fact, you might be assigned to a case 3 years after somebody started it. And I needed to find out, well, what do we know already? So we had to use computers. Now we've even moved beyond with predictive coding and other types of assistance that the machines can read the documents, and we had to actually read them and then put the code in the information. Nowadays, the machine will read them, and sometimes by using a seed of some sort, we would identify that one makes sense, this one's good, that one's not good. The machine would start learning that, these are good documents, those aren't good documents. By pattern recognition, we wouldn't have to say, this is good because you could just identify piles and it would start learning, and then you'd keep training it. And that's the way a lot of discovery is done. Now, it means that a lot of lawyers, their first job, they were getting paid by the hour, and law firms were getting paid by the hour to go through these tons of documents. It's now being done much more cheaply and efficiently by machines, but it also means a small law firm can do it.
Yeah, I mean, legal research is a huge part of what we train lawyers to be able to do. And now metadata takes care of a lot of the groundwork of being able to get to the information you need.
I mean, years ago, it used to be you had a real advantage if you had a really good law library. Mm-hmm. And so law firms had law libraries that had the documents that a small firm couldn't have. So they had a competitive advantage. I think nowadays every lawyer has the same competitive advantage. You can look up almost the same documents, the same cases that the big firms can do. So that, I think, is a good thing. The access to the knowledge has increased. The bad news in all of this is that if that was your expertise, you have to evolve or else you're going to be in trouble. That people aren't going to pay you for the thing that they used to pay you for. We're still going to have lawyers, but they're going to be lawyers that use AI-driven tools. I can remember years ago when I came out of school, and you know, if you saw a lawyer who didn't have a computer, you'll kind of, oh, that's sort of an antique. But the old lawyers, well, oh, I don't have that. That's what secretaries have. They have typewriters on their desk. Well, nobody had typewriters, and you know, if I went to a law firm and nobody was using computers, I would think, well, okay, this is not a law firm I want to deal with.
It's a paradigm shift. It's a huge paradigm shift.
We resisted email for a long while. Oh, it's not safe and everything. You can't imagine trying to deal with clients today and say, well, we don't use email. You have to actually show up or wait for the letter to arrive. it's just so different. And that's not that long a period of time.
This also for the clients means, I'm assuming, a lot less money being able to spend, which increases their ability to hire a lawyer.
Yeah, and I think that's the good news side.
Right.
One of the things, not just the people that already were hiring lawyers, but we have to remember we have a huge amount of the population that does not have adequate access to the law. Not just, you know, criminals that are picked up, but everyday activities. You're a small business, and I have to go through the regulatory permitting process. If you've ever bought a house, you realize, wow, this gets complicated, where the title search and what do these documents mean? People want you to sign things.
Yeah, I mean, an interesting angle that was in one of the Forbes articles you forwarded me on this. Dean Song Richardson, the University of California Irvine School of Law, brought up the fact AI could increase productivity for lawyers to serve vulnerable populations where they didn't have access to justice at all, and which just wasn't an option because of the financial burden.
I mean, it's the same thing that the Industrial Revolution, where we handcrafted, let's say, a rifle. It was very expensive and only a few people could have them. Mm-hmm. Once we could mass produce those, every frontiers person could have a rifle. Every person could have very fancy fabrics because they weren't handcrafted the way they might have been in the past. Back in 2004, in our own state, one of our former faculty members, who was then on the Supreme Court, headed up a task force on self-representation in New Hampshire. And just to give you an idea of how big of a problem this is and continues to be, that task force found that one party is pro se, which means they're representing themselves without a lawyer, in 85% of all the civil cases in our entry level, what now is called the circuit courts, but then it was called the district courts. 85%, those people that could use some sort of assistance, even if it has to come from a machine. That's better than no assistance.
Exactly.
Or it might also allow somebody like a lawyer to say, I can now service 40 people, and this now makes a viable business, as opposed to, I can only service 3.
Right.
Because of the time, it's not as efficient.
Yeah. So, I mean, are you beginning to see the ramp up of courts, judges, and attorneys beginning to, I mean, is it ubiquitous, at least at this point, where basically databases and digital tools are entirely the norm nowadays?
I was on the task force that was asked to modernize our courts a number of years back. And the idea was to go electronic.
Right.
One of the interesting things was that the cost of keeping all the records was becoming a serious budget item. You have to store
shipping
the items. You have to store them. You have to store them in a way that the paper doesn't get, you know, waterlogged or mildewed or eaten by the insects. So it's not an inexpensive space. That alone would have been worth the project, but it also made convenience. You could file documents from your office. You know, you didn't have to go down perhaps to the courthouse to file the things.
Administrative assistance needed to collect everything.
That lowers the cost for your clients, which is really what we want. We want to provide law in the cheapest, most efficient way for everyone, not just those that can afford it the most.
With everything moving digital, we just like with the healthcare industry, there's very obvious privacy concerns that come up with putting client information out there digitally, putting it into computer systems to sort out, like putting their personal information on servers so that the computer does a portion of the lawyering work. How has some of this been addressed?
I think you've hit upon one of the really deeply concerning areas of the current techniques of artificial intelligence or machine learning looking into data to do pattern recognition, the predictive analytics that they come up with, making a decision based on data I've analyzed. And the difficulty is I have to look at some data, and that data is somebody's. That data could have biases built in. Because if I'm looking at, well, where did we lend for real estate over the past 100 years, we're going to see a bias against poor neighborhoods or certain populations in the country. So if that becomes the way we predict how we should do this, then that bias might get cooked in and we're not aware of it. Oh, the machine told us this is how we should make these decisions. Mm-hmm. If we have judges that are starting to be, you know, AI assisted, analyzing, oh, is this person going to be somebody that's perhaps going to have a high recidivism rate? I need to give this person worse terms, lock them up longer, or don't let them have bail, or have higher bail, or have some other activity to make sure that they don't cause that problem.
You lose the individuality and personal, and that comes into a lot of these decisions.
And if I don't understand that some of these algorithms, we don't, they're not as transparent. We don't know exactly how the deep learning came up with the answer. That can cause a problem for the law. I mean, we're going to need more transparency. And the people are working on that now. So we're looking at how the deep learning technique, how did they come up with that algorithm? What did they look at? So we can assess, and people can question that particular algorithm that, because this is all math. I mean, that's all computers can do is do math. How can we understand that?
And that would definitely be a concern if we're increasing the volume of people that are in vulnerable populations. We were just talking about the ability of more people being able to access the systems. If we're just ending up hurting that population even more, I mean, we're going to be back to where we started with.
I mean, we're already using these techniques. So, I mean, it's not something so far in the future.
Right.
You've probably seen this idea of predictive policing that's used by a number of police forces. Police have limited resources. They have to apply the policing where it has the most bang for the buck. So they're using data analysis to say, okay, it's more likely a crime is going to be committed in this area. Let's put more police there. If nothing else, you know, they will be closer to the scene of the crime.
Right.
But the people then are asking, well, does that then make it more likely that that gets hit as a predictive place to go? Because, well, the police are there and they catch more people there.
Yeah, it's a vicious circle there.
Is it feeding? Unless we understand, well, what's feeding your prediction? I've got to be careful with that. I'm missing, you know, the rich guy in the mansion who's committing a bigger crime.
Yeah.
Because you know nobody's in there catching him. I think the probable cause issue is going to be interesting because we've had this already with terrorism. We have a watch list. Where do we get the watch list? These are people that haven't perhaps committed any crimes, but we're watching them. Why? Because somewhere, some computers have said these people have a higher risk. Mm-hmm. Now, we're just watching. But what happens when this becomes like the Minority Report, the book in the movie, or the new book in Britain, Zed, or whatever it is. Can we start going, I can do search and seizure. That's sufficient probable cause. And when you think of probable cause, the probability, can the machine provide me with that, to a judge, with that amount of probability that makes that judge comfortable with, yes, go check and see if they really do, you know, have these weapons or this set of drugs, or they're planning this activity. It's going to be a tough question of where that balance comes, because we're already doing some of this already, and necessarily so, perhaps.
What are your predictions for the future of artificial intelligence in the legal industry? What do you think are kind of the short-term advances that are expected?
Well, I think one thing we have a clear understanding that I don't think AI, as we define it today, will be replacing lawyers anytime soon. But lawyers who don't use artificial intelligence techniques and artificial intelligence in the practice, those will be replaced by those who do. So it's something that we will have to embrace as a profession. it can help us rewrite laws. I think one thing right now, we have way too complex financial regulations. Mm-hmm. We have all these new fintech companies, they're trying to get in, and they're trying to make sense of just the Dodd-Frank rules or know your client rules or all these different rules that they have to try to start up a sort of peer-to-peer lending organization. Artificial intelligence can help us, not only perhaps help people go through this morass of complications that we have, but maybe help us write better laws and sort out the ones that aren't helping anymore and make better laws. I mean, we will have law being driven perhaps by artificial intelligence, and that can be helpful. Regulations that have a smart sense to them, people can see, oh, that's going to cause a problem. You know, if you ask people to do this, then this is going to be a problem at some point. I mean, one thing that's going to be clear is that artificial intelligence itself will be a subject area of the law. The privacy issues, if you think of an autonomous car, essentially the AI is driving that.
Liability.
Your car is collecting information. When the car hits somebody, did you do it? You're not driving. I just bought the car. You know, the software is going to be bought by this company, that company. We're going to have a whole area of trying to figure out how we assign that liability, who has to insure it, and so on and so forth. Because there'll be accidents. There'll be fewer accidents than we have now, but we'll have to deal with that. I think, you know, healthcare and the legal regulation, very heavily regulated industry, will have to also be thinking about this because, you know, stuff's dangerous. And we have to, and lawyers, sue doctors. What's the standard of care? What's the standard of care for malpractice? What will be that standard of care for lawyers? Mm-hmm. If you didn't use that artificial intelligence research and you missed that critical regulation that your client now is violating, are you going to be in trouble?
Thanks for listening to the UNH Law Podcast. Learn more about us by visiting law.unh.edu or following UNH Law on social media. Be sure to comment and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Spotify. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or host and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire.